Hi, everybody. This is Alex Watts, and host of the Indofunctor podcast. Today, I have Mr. Hyung-suk Kang with me. He is the founder CEO of Standard, which is bringing waifus to the masses. Is that the correct way to think of it?
We can't say that. Well, in technical way, we provide fully on-chain clop, and on top of that, we build waifus on top of it. You know, like for market making and all these other stuff. Yeah.
Very, very cool. Yeah. So before you started putting waifus on clobs, what were you up to?
So I was actually working on AI stuff, and I was very interested in this telemedicine stuff to detect diseases on like with using AI. So back then I was working on this medical device where you take a image of the inside of your eye, and then you see this like a fundus image or something. It's just like a word coin, but then you use it for medical purposes. And then when I was working in that startup, it was pretty obvious that you can actually see if one has like a diabetic retinopathy. Fundus image just. So it's the diabetic retinopathy. So when people get to diabetes, there are like side effects where it harms your eyes. And there are some devices which just detect that by just taking an image from inside of your eye. And then if you look into it, there's some yellow like stuff sort of like just clinging around those like veins or something. And then you use like a AI model using CNN or maybe ResNet to detect that. So we built that AI. I mean, it wasn't that hard, to be honest. Like there are some cases which is like obviously like showing the diabetic retinopathy. But then I think we didn't kind of make it to the selling the device because the device was just too big. We're trying to aim it for wearing it as like a VR goggle, but then it just seems like it requires much more a requirement to make an optic lenses and all that. So the team did not work out. So we just kind of have to go. And before that, I was kind of working on the IoT research. So that's where I kind of decided to build a medical device. I was working on the some IoT lab on my university, building some, you know, like a, something like an ENS, we call it in blockchain, or some naming system for IoT devices. So when you make a when you install a network and then you connect the devices and then you want to differentiate which device is connected to which home network and which, we call that like a DNSNA. So I was kind of helping working on it. And then I was like, okay, why not we use like a phone to prove that this is my device within the network so that I can prevent the hackers to come in and then just claim like a control of the IoT devices. So I started to develop on that idea with my master guys in the lab, and then built some technology called SDNSNA, you know, just securing these IoT device identity with the asymmetric cryptography. You can think of it as like a, you know, like a, we have wallets, right? It's like you're giving a wallet the keys for each IoT devices to verify that this is the device in the network.
So kind of like TLS?
Sorry, TLS? Kind of like- TLS. Something like that. Yeah. So after like kind of failing on the medical startup, I was kind of working interested in that Bitcoin book. So I've been trying to read the Mastering Bitcoin. So before that, I was kind of in the army at that time. It was like 2017. And then I just studying myself, trying to work on crypto, and then just went to starting to go with the crypto hackathons, and then somehow met a guy in San Francisco to work on blockchain consulting. So I've been working on some building ERC-20s at that time. Also received some Bitcoin for, you know, working on that. I should have saved Bitcoin at that time when it was like $1,000 or like $500 at that point. But I don't know. I don't remember the exact prices, but it was definitely below than like 10K or something. So yeah. And then after that, I just kind of went to like the San Francisco to work in Samsung or building those like kind of like DID stuff because I was, you know, literally giving the wallet kind of ID to the IoT devices and just realized that just got bored about it. And yeah, so that's like my, and then got out. Yeah. That's pretty much the before crypto. Yeah.
That's awesome. So the reason why you got into crypto was that you were in San Francisco and you ran into, was it like a friend or how did that connection happen?
Oh, so I kind of attended the Korean crypto hackathon called like Block Party at that time. And then somehow met a guy from San Francisco there. And then that guy just offered me like, why don't we just work together? You know, there's like the consulting. And then I started a consulting company, a job for that. But it's not like a, you know, consulting in like the top five or something. It was just like a little dev shop working on smart contracts and all that. Yeah.
Got it. So Let me ask you this. So these days you are, you know, arguably one of the most prolific, you know, commenters and posters inside of the Monad community for builders, which is how, you know, we connected and how I think a lot of people, you know, would recognize you. You are working on a lot of very interesting stuff. You're building a CLOB, which is a central limit order book, which is by itself just like a very, you know, very complex thing to build. But then you're also, correct me if I'm wrong, but you have you plan to have an AI wealth management system on top of it. And these AIs are going to be the Y, you know, WAI foos, like the waifus. And I'm very impressed with like, not just what you're building and like, you know, how it works, but also with like the scope of it. And so what I would love, like before we start getting into the nitty gritty of the technology, which I really want to dial down into, what I would love to learn about is how you ended up deciding to build what you're currently building and like walk me through the path and the stages of how you moved like each next iteration.
So there has been a lot of trial and error. I mean, I really appreciate that you comment the like building a really good projects and all that, but it just really came up from a lot of iterations throughout the 5 years so far. So let me go through that journey. So before I was making standard, so after finishing Samsung, I told you, and then just decided to just, you know, just chill a bit and then try to finish these schools, I guess. But then there was this one guy from like Korean blockchain house called Nonce or something, and then just asked me that if I want to work in some blockchain company in Korea. And then they say that it's the biggest. And I was like, what is it? And then they were like, oh, it's the payment. We're building a stable coin for the payment and the e-commerce. And I was like, okay, let's go. And then that's how I first met Dokwon. Yeah.
And oh shit, I didn't know this.
Yeah, I mean, so like there was some shady stuff going on in Terra and from the rumors I heard. But then that was the largest company in Korea that I can go regarding crypto. And then so I was like, okay, maybe I can fix him, you know? And like it's just like I was like, okay, maybe I can fix the company, and then got into that, and then that's when the whole trouble actually began. I mean, like, so for the first day of the company, I went inside the company room, and then they were just showing off this like API documentation for this new payment gateway called Chai, and then I definitely like tested it out, and then there was this API example to look over the purchase records. And then when I opened it, I was able to see someone from, I don't know, someone from like a e-commerce founder's email on the API examples with the purchase records with the address on it.
Oh, and God.
It looked quite crazy because, like, you know, if you expose that in Korea, it charges about like around like $100 per users for exposing their personal information. And then if they release it in public, so Chai was at that time was having a lot of users with the network with the e-commerce platform called Ticketmaster. And then it was over like 100K users so far. And then if we have to pay all of that, the company would definitely go bankrupt. So I just started to report that to the head of the development. And then he just forwarded me to the CTO. I forwarded to CTO, and then he forwarded me to Do Kwon. And then I told Do Kwon about this. And then he asked me to go to head developer. So it's just going round again. Like, it's like, what is going on with the operation? I was like, okay. That's when I started to thinking that this is fishy. And I think after I said that, I'm pretty sure like CEO and CTO and the head of development just got grouped together and then realized that it was a problem. And then one other thing that I know at that time was that their company lawyer just got fired. And that was like, okay, it's pretty crazy at that time. Right. So, Oh, wow. So like, so things have passed in like 2 months. And then like, there was this time when Do Kwon just kind of got like crazy. I think there was like some call between the other founder, Daniel Shin or whatever. I don't know. I don't know what the co-founder is, but like I think they had some bad time, and then just Do Kwon started to smash the desk and then in the office, and then like, these projects are scams. We're looking at the Ampleforth, and I was like, well, what the fuck is going on, man? He's like, he's so fucking unstable. And then one day he just called me out for an internal company hackathon, and then asked me out to build this implementation of basis.io. So so there was, I think basis.io was like a project from some naval, I'm not sure what the name was, but then the last thing I remember was like he was charged with some fraud. And anyway, he gave me this idea of this algorithmic stable coin where this supply and demand, it's like creating the peg of the stable coin and then maintains the price or whatever, instead of just thinking about the CDP or whatever. So okay, he asked me to write the code for like 20 hours, and then like they said it has to be done like 3 days. And then me and the other like three guys were in there, and then one of them I think were trying to and then one of them was from UCLA or something. And then I just told that UCLA guy that, okay, you cannot make this basis cash. It has to be involved with some collateral with the real US dollar. And then suddenly these blockchain UCLA kind of released the Frax. So I was like, okay, but that's the another part. But then like, so I actually wrote the code, and then the Do Kwon, what he did was pretty much put the USB into my computer, took it out, and then and plugged it into his computer, and then submitted a commit called DeFi Rick. And, you know, the rest is history while doing the marketing and all these kind of stuff. I'm pretty sure right now, I think they had already had a good network to make a Ponzi on themselves. Like, so after that incident, I didn't get any credit. And then Do Kwon started to call investors about it. Hey, this is the project that they are going to launch or whatever. And I was like thinking, okay, well, you know, like they can get funded for like stealing projects. And then I was like so mad. I mean, at that time. And then I just thought that this industry would just kind of implode by just making one another Ponzi with other like kind of founder with the rich network, and just fuck up the whole industry. And then we just have to own up to their failures. And then I was like, okay, maybe this industry needs a standard and then some protective boundary for me to actually not engage with these scammers. So I just decided to just build my own company instead. So that's how my iteration began. So, you know, to make a standard, you basically have to go with a lot of prior errors, I think. So like, yeah. So somehow, luckily, I was able to be funded by some former like exchange, some cousin of exchange in Korea, listing director or something. But then it turns out that they're also like shady and then trying to use my technical skills to get the products and then just collect the money and stuff. So it took some 3 years to kick them out for embezzlement and all that. But now I'm okay with that. But the product that I was working on for the project was the collateralized rebaseable stablecoin, I call it. So it was basically a CDP. You can think of it like an on-chain Ethena, where if you get liquidated, it for the CDP, the liquidation goes to the DEX and then just tries to buy up and then burn the stablecoin released in there. So like if it's over-collateralized, it seems like very much doable to maintain the pack, but it didn't. I was like rethinking like why that happened, and then just realized that Uniswap V2 is not providing a good detailed instruments on the volatility of the stablecoin price. So for stablecoin, it is very important to maintain the peg between the $1. Mm-hmm. And if you have a less liquidity, it's really hard to get the numbers correct. So I just thought that, okay, we need to build the trading instrument so that it does not, it requires me to control the volatility. And basically we did not have enough liquidity to build the stablecoin infrastructure. So I just decided to build my own DEX, and it took a long time to just come with the capital efficiency. At first I thought concentrated liquidity is the way, but then just realized that AMMs are just only supporting market orders. So it is quite hard to form up the liquidity from the exact prices that we prefer. So I've been thinking a lot and then just decided to switch it into a clot model just to make a more stable and then more more clarity. And then, yeah, I mean, so we also researched on the order book side where it went wrong. So a lot of the order book DEXs are now trying to store the order in a contract and then try to match it off chain. That's how Ether Delta was doing. And then it was got regulated by SEC that this is not right due to the, I don't know the term that they call it, was from the SEC. I think Robin was also like was charged with that, where you, so it's like you manage the, so it's like you can think of it as like an off-chain client as like a broker dealers, but then these broker dealers can actually like make a trades that is not optimal for each users to trade.
It's like violating the national best bid and ask.
National NBBD. What? Yeah.
There's this, go ahead. But actually, so before we start talking about clobs, do you mind if I double click on a few of the things that you mentioned with regards to the stablecoin stuff?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you know this about me. It's like, I didn't know that you were this involved with the stablecoin side of things. So this is fascinating to me. I don't know if you know this about me, but I got my start in MEV. The very first thing I started doing MEV on was a, you know, partial reserve stablecoin protocol called Iron Finance, which sounds a lot like it was forked from something that you originally created. And so what you're talking about now about how the Uniswap architecture, which is not, this is not their fault, by the way, you know, Uniswap is Uniswap. They weren't designing this to be for stablecoin partial reserve protocols, but your comment about how the Uniswap, you know, X times Y equals K, you know, swap formulas at the time were not super helpful for partial reserve stablecoins. That resonates with me because that literally is how I, you know, made money and like got my started in MEV and like honestly in crypto. I was still working my TradFi job back when I wrote that program. And so like that resonates with me a lot. And one of the things that I think is like very interesting is that there were some other attack vectors there too that you could do around like sandwiching the stablecoin as it was doing larger rebalances. And one of the interesting things with clobs is that you can't really sandwich a clob. You can front run, a club. You know, you can take orders, you know, you can eat up, you know, parts of the order book that are, you know, going to be going for someone else. But once you push through liquidity on a club, it's not like all of a sudden all of the buys just convert into sells and they're there to push through again on the way back down, if that makes sense. Whereas for a AMM like Uniswap, like X times Y equals K, if you move the rate from like 99 to 100 and, you know, send like, you know, let's say $1 million to go through and that pushes the price up from 99 to 100, then there will still be $1 million worth of liquidity if you push back down from 100 to 99, because all of those buys, all of those bids, X times Y equals K converts them into sells. Whereas when you push through them, whereas with clobs, it's kind of like those, you know, bids are gone, but now there's this huge gap between 99 and 100. And so there's no way to like profit when you go back the other direction for the sandwich. And so I find that very interesting because I personally did a lot of modeling, like spreadsheet stuff for exactly what you're talking about. This is very interesting. I'm super, dude, so we can talk about this subject for a long time. I would love to send you some of my models at some point, but
I'm actually want to make a paper out of it. And then I hope there's like a research group that could actually do this, but then no one actually built the real club right now. And DYDX, I heard that they're doing it, but then I don't know where they are, you know, like I'm not sure what they're doing. And then to be honest, to enable this kind of research, you have to actually open up the order book itself. But then the problem of these like off-chain client that does the order book is that their data is kind of siloed. So, and if you want to open it up, everyone will know what you're going to do. And then there is no like a clear execution rules or anything. And you're going to pretty much get so much debate about it unless, you know, you just make it clear so that, you know. But on the other hand, I just try to put that matching algorithm into fully on-chain so that it is on the smart contract. So we will be the pretty much the only fully on-chain clock protocol that is verified on Scanner. So we're fully on-chain. So one thing to compare, if you don't know whether this protocol is fully on-chain or not, you can just go into the Scanner and then see the verified contract. If you do that, then you can figure out that if it's fully on-chain or not by looking at the how orders are just matched. So yeah, I think, you know, once I just set the trading rule and then we're not trying to be like a brokers trying to take a profit, unlike Robinhood, I think we can do something like open research and all that. Yeah.
That is very interesting. So yeah. From my point of view, so I do want to point out that like I don't think you're the only person building a central limit order book on Monad. I think most people, like right now, I think you're very widely known in developer circles. I think most retail people, when they think, you know, CLOB on Monad, they think Kuru. And it is my understanding that Kuru will also have a verified smart contract and do on-chain matching. However, I don't believe that part is currently live yet on testnet. I could be wrong. But from my perspective, it looks like you guys are both thinking very like directionally similar. Would that be like a fair assessment?
So even though I'm a technical founder, I respect what Kuru is doing. I think we're doing the same thing and we should actually do something together. I don't believe that technical advancement is actually helping to have more customers in the end, because we have all seen Pumped Up Fund making so much money out of it. So I just want to cheer them working on it. And I like their approach trying to form up the trading liquidity with the many tokens so far. So since they're occupied with that, I'm trying to differentiate myself to have a curated listing for tokens that are deployed on Kuru. So for users, they can both benefit from Kuru and us by launching a token on Kuru. And if you think that your token is worth to get listed on exchange, we can definitely again curate the volumes from the Kuru and then select them to be listed on us. And then we also provide some unique pricing mechanisms so that we can pump the price up just like BitGet does on the Innovation Zone. So we try to call it like something like that, so that when the TGE happens, we can protect the large cells from the like paper hands. If they do that, we can just adjust the slippage limit so that the sell orders would be making prices go lower than the buys, so that we can actually adjust that for now.
Can I double click on that? Can you elaborate on what you mean by adjusting the slippage limit? And specifically, I guess, like, what would the context of this be? Like, in what circumstances would you do this? Because I think that, like, directionally, I understand, like, the general idea of, like, you know, adjusting the slippage limit, which is, like, really the way DeFi uses it, is just, like, the maximum allowed price impact before a trade reverts. Whereas in, like, TradFi, slippage is more of just, like, you know, what happens to the price of the thing you're buying in between when you hit the submit button and when you, like, you know, when the trade actually goes through. And so, and then, like, the DeFi version kind of, like, wraps around the TradFi version, is how I would say it, because you can definitely have that impacting the price impact as well. So, yeah, I guess, like, my question for you, though, is, like, if you're limiting the slippage, or rather you're allowing more slippage on the way up than on the way down, first of all, the question is, like, how does that, like, how do you do that? Is this something where your front end is setting that for the user and, like, the DeFi sense of the word? Or is this more like a TradFi thing where on the back end, like, for in your case, the smart contract has, like, actual, like, price impact, like, limits that are different for buys than for sells, let's say?
So I try to do that with the backend side. So it all started from protecting the in-sandwich attacks. So you can think of, if I don't set slippage limit, it can definitely go like, remember you're doing the modeling for the AMM. That can actually happen the same for CLOP when one is not doing a slippage limit. So basically, let's just suppose a situation where Ethereum price is like 2,500. And there's a gap, obviously, in the bid side where the highest bid is actually placed in $1. And then lowest ask is actually placed in like 3,000 or something. And then if we don't apply the slippage limit and trader just go market sell, the price would just jump down from 2,500 to $1. Because it's a market sell. You have to find the highest bid and then match it. So I had that problem, and then I was begging for that cracker to just get out of that order book or something. So I just realized that there had to be some kind of like mechanisms to maintain the price. So like our like community member in our Discord just suggested me that why not we have like a market buy or market sell. When they do that, they don't go high or low as like all the way, but then just stop it there. So I listened to them and then just started to think of a way where the price is getting the limit on increase or decrease regardless of the order formations. So just like Uniswap B3 does. Uniswap B3, okay, they place the liquidity too, but then they have this price mechanism where they move from the logarithmic where from the previous market price and then go up or down. We try to apply the same. And then we have this like some cases where it overlaps with the highest bid or it overlaps with the lowest ask or it does not exist in some initial situations. So when I kind of added that thing, we just had like a 64 cases or something. And then I had to test it out all of that in smart contract. And we have been also doing some testnet launches like 3 times in the net right now. And then I think it's now working pretty good. And what we're trying to add is that and then we also figured out that we can also make a situation where the token price wouldn't go down if some catastrophic situation happens. This sometimes happens on a Korean stock exchange. We call that situation like a sidecar. We can also kind of activate that with the agreement of the project team or whatever. And also we can adjust some slippage limits so that if seller is trying to sell, we can just let it go down gradually. It does not like we actually stop it, but it just goes down really slow while the other side by side can go up when there's no cellular or something.
So I think like there are maybe three different mental models. I think all three of these mental models are flawed in one way, because I think what you're describing is like a very complex and very interesting mechanism. But would you say that this is more along the lines of you adding in liquidity to fill in the missing gaps? Would this be more like your front end is just saying that, hey, user, I know you wanted to swap this much, but we were actually only able to swap a portion of that because liquidity on these other sides? Or is this more like a circuit breaker, like in TradFi, where if the price moves a certain amount in a certain period of time, all of a sudden sells or buys are just turned off until the circuit breaker comes back on?
We can also apply the circuit breaker, but then the mental model that I'm trying to describe is that when there's no liquidity around, we just go, okay, we don't have that. We try to incentivize trading by making the price go up, but then not too much that goes out of control. So like when you can think of it as like a situation when sellers are not there and then buyers are just abundant, the price would just go up to the slippage limit that we set. When sellers are abundant and buyers not there, the price would just gradually go down when there's no like bid order, so that the buyers can actually match up to that. So I was like, okay, maybe it's too uncontrolled. Maybe it's just better to leave it to the community. But then we just realized that there's also MEB that uses that to manipulate the price. So in like 1 hour, Bitcoin, wrapped Bitcoin price was like 10,000, but then it just turned out like $1. And then when I put it back, it was like 10,000. The situation was quite crazy. So it was like, okay, maybe we need a price control, just like Uniswap, but then maybe just try to go more on that. And then just started to deploy a different mechanism. So the difference between Uniswap would be like, they go like logarithmic price increase and decrease based on the fee tiers and the liquidity. But we try to be independent from the liquidity. And then we just let the project team or some of our market making team to handle that. But we try to set it the maximum to like 0.7%, because 1% is just too out of control. Over 1% seems like not a good idea for making a sustainable market.
Let me ask you this, just to make sure I've got the foundation correct. So let's say I'm doing a swap on Standard and I'm trying to trade $100,000 worth of Bitcoin. Let's just say one Bitcoin. And let's say that there is maybe, I'm trying to buy $100,000 worth of Bitcoin with USDC. And let's say that there is a $50,000 sell order right at the current price. And then there's a massive gap, just no liquidity, complete lack of sell orders until maybe another $50,000 worth of sell orders, but at like $200,000 per Bitcoin, which hopefully by the time people are listening to this, Bitcoin's trading slightly above 100K. So my question for you is, like, in that atomic moment where my trade is going through, does it half fill and I just get $50,000 worth of Bitcoin and the other half just remains unexecuted? Or is there like community provided, like backstop liquidity that kind of instantly comes in and provides the remaining 50K? Or like, what would my experience be as a user interacting with this part of your central limit order book?
So similar to Central's exchange, 50K will be matched. And then 50K will be placed in the price that you set if it's like a limit order. If you go with the market buy, 50K will be matched. And then the other 50K will be applied with the slippage limit and then go up and then be placed in the order, which is like 0.7% up than the original price.
Got it. And so then someone else, so like, I'll be placed up. So like the unfilled portion. So like let's say there's 60K existing liquidity. So I've got 40K unfilled. So I get immediately executed for 60K and then 40K gets converted into a bid, which then other people can be, you know, incentivized to come in and fill. And my bid is going to be filled from, you know, whatever the current price is up to a max of 0.7% above. Is that
yeah, and correct? Then when you do market buy, you can also adjust that slippage limit. So it could be within like 0.7%, but you could also set it like a 0.3. If you want to just stay there and then just hedge, you can just adjust the amount of order that you want to match. If you just want to go all the way up, you can just increase the number of orders to match into like 50 or 20 or something. But if you just want to stay within the closest price range, you can also set that 1 or 2 so that it will be only matched in that 60K within the orders and then just stay there.
You had mentioned the number of orders that you want to fill. So I think one of the things that a lot of central limit order books, especially inside of the EVM, have come across is this concept of like dusting orders, where, you know, if you have too many very low like volume or just like low value orders, then it costs gas to iterate through each one of these, right? Like it takes up compute, and that compute is something that cannot be used on other stuff, right? Compute at the end of the day is a limited resource in pretty much every blockchain. And so the problem becomes, if you accept all of these super tiny orders, then all of a sudden you can have like 100,000 or 1 million just tiny, tiny orders that a buyer then has to kind of loop and iterate through all of them in order to fill. And this has been a problem for like a lot of central limit order books. And I guess like my question for you would be, is this a problem in your model? And if so, how are you guys looking at solving it?
So we definitely have that problem. So that's why we just sorted the order size from the biggest to smallest, so that the dusted order will be actually just kind of go the later stage, so that when people actually swap, they can always have the big chunks of the liquidity that is placed on the order book. One other thing that we solved is that once trading amount is below a certain amount, we just make it to be executed and then just clear that order book. So we have this condition where we just clear the order book when the calculation is below a certain number that is considered to be like a dust. So we just try to match it so that the dust is not counted. I think we had that case in like 8 months ago. I also applied the test case in the GitHub code. But dusting order is still a kind of bugging things for me. Even though I put the test code, I try to watch on what orders that I can fill up. But usually when people just go all the way, like 20 orders or something, it kind of disappears.
How are you guys looking at figuring out what the volume or like what the value is? Like what's the threshold to be considered a dust when you guys are going through and clearing the small orders?
I think it was 1,000 way. And from the precision that I've been going through, that's how I decided. So 1,000 way was pretty much the okay dust way when the token was trading. So when it comes down to USDC and USDT, you get really kind of last chance that things will happen at that time. So if it's like that's like 6 decimal 1,000 way would be like 0.01 cent. So I was thinking, okay, maybe losing 1 cent is actually fine, unless they go with the crazy like Bitcoin price and then just set the decimals like 6 or something. But I don't think they will do that. Like, I mean, it's quite crazy. Like, you make an asset like Bitcoin and then you put decimals in like 6.
USDC. Pretty risky
idea.
USDC.
USDC is like $1, you know? Like, but like Bitcoin with the 6 decimals is like, I don't want to deal with that. No way. Yeah.
I think Chainlink actually uses 8. I think Link is like the outlier. So back when I was doing MEV, the decimal thing always frustrated me because there was not like all of like the really, really old ones, Bitcoin, USDC, and USDT used 6. Link uses 8. And then like pretty much every, like all of them since then use 18, like DAI, which will always have a special place in my heart for being the first major stablecoin to have 18 decimals, which, because I was doing a lot of stablecoin arbitrage, was very important to me. And like DAI will always have a special place in my heart because of that. But yeah, that's interesting. Have you guys considered like using like the midpoint and just trying to correlate back to a USD valuation? Or how are you getting the USD valuation? Or better question, are all of your pairs denominated in USD?
Yeah, we have worked on our indexers to figure out the price between. So one thing that we do when we list on our exchange, we first list with our stablecoins. So it could be USDC or USDT. Once the price is set from the asset, the USD price is pretty much the one to that, right? So there's like two mechanisms where Base is getting the proxy price up from that stablecoin pair when there's like Bitcoin or ETH or something. We also go with the quote proxy pair, where there are some four cases that goes crazy on that, you know. So it's like you have to figure out the, so like, you know, here's the thing. So there's this new coin, and then there's the other coin, like let's call it Mon/ETH, and then I don't know Mon's USD price, but then I know Ethereum's USD price. Then I can figure out the Monad price. Or you go to Base and quote, and then I don't know the Mon price on the quote, but then I know the base USD price on ETH. And then we apply this crazy like division and multiplications from getting the proxy pair price between the stablecoin, and then we figure out the USD price of overall. But I'm not sure if it's accurate though. Maybe it's just better to list on USDC and then just apply the same thing. I think that's why many centralized exchanges are just default doing with the USDT and the other assets, and then try to move with the ETH price instead. So I think I'm just gonna list on like USDT and the others so that I can get the better price on it.
Do you think there's like a concern around liquidity too? I imagine that if you support 50 tokens and each one of them is a pair with USD, then if someone needs to go from one token to another token, you can just go token A to USD to token B. You've got two separate pairs, two separate spreads that you have to work your way through. But you don't have to deal with fragmented liquidity. Whereas if you allow for every possible combination of all 50 tokens, then all of a sudden you have a lot more than just 50 pairs, each of which will need its own order book. And so you have 2,500, if I'm doing the math right in my head. And so like, is that the right way to think about it, where there's a liquidity fragmentation aspect of it too? Or is that something that maybe could be abstracted without adding a whole bunch of extra spreads per hop into the path?
So we could call it the liquidity fragmentation, but I see these order book as like an atomic swap. So I think there's definitely pros and cons. You can think of it as like a liquidity is fragmented, but then if these liquidities are just all connected together like a Uniswap, it actually creates a lot of gas fees when you're trying to hop around. So when you try to hop two times on the AMM, I heard when I tested on the wallet, it costs like 3 million gas. But when you just trade on the order book for like 20 orders, it costs 2 million gas on my clock. So it can't be a lot gas saving, even though it's like liquidity fragmented. But also MEV opportunities just always exist in these swapping, right? I mean, we kind of get into the situation where every pair is connected, even though liquidity is not there enough. So that's why it ends up like the 5% or 10% slippage limit in the swaps. But our audience is basically traders who can wait for their time, you know, just submitting a limit order. Oh, I'm not going to sell or buy at this price or whatever. And, you know, they don't want to risk slippage limit. I just saw this kind of like a pattern for Bitcoin OTC buyers. So they don't want to trade Bitcoin to US dollar if the slippage is over 5%. You know, but then if you try to trade that Bitcoin into the DEX, usually when the volume is around 25 million or 15 million, and if you're trying to trade on a DEX, the slippage is so high. Sometimes it's 90%, sometimes it's 15%. So I expect for more big buyers with more account value to trade securely with some time to proceed with the trading. So I think that would help on the liquidity side too. So what I'm trying to market is to aim for these institutions or some big holders to buy or sell assets into the price that they want. So, yeah.
That makes sense. Let me ask you this. For your central limit order book, when people are trading through it, are you guys looking at, like, let's say someone wants to go from only a multiple hop path and so like not through an AMM, but through you guys. Mm-hmm. It would just be like, you know, direct, or it would just be like multiple hop, or what would be the?
Oh, it would be just direct. Yeah, I don't think I would expect multiple hops from them. But it would be great if I could have a trading aggregator. Someone could do that.
That was going to be my next question. Because I think, like, with you guys, it's permissionless, you know, so you can always start up, like, the thing. But I guess, like, my question for you is for your front end. So this is more like a front end, you know, a UI, UX thing than, like, a mechanism thing. But, like, would your front end be able to calculate, like, hey, is it better to just hit this direct pool? Or is it better to go, like, you know, fast lane token to USDC and then USDC to, like, you know, standard token or something like that?
I want to make that, but right now I'm just really focusing on the direct thing done. I haven't really made the order book for now. So, like, I'm just really trying to improve on the one thing first. And then once I do that, I might let my waifu to handle that and then use LMM to give that price to you and then just trade on it. And I think it's actually interesting. So applying AMM design is definitely in consideration. So I actually met the Jim from Thigman Capital, and then he told me that there's this, like, a project from SoFi. And SoFi was turned out to be made from the Ellipsis lab, which actually made the clop on the Solana. And then they have been taking up, like, over 20% of the volume or just order routing on the Jupiter right now. So Jupiter is the aggregator that you talk about. And it seems like they use something like an order book, but then put some AMM interface. And it kind of interests me on that, so that maybe we'll have something like that in future. But right now, just to be humble, like, I'm just really busy trying to make one thing work. That's my next step, I think. Yeah.
That's awesome. I really respect the drive to doing one thing and doing it really well. Speaking of, so you'd mentioned the waifus, or, you know, the waifu. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what role they will play? Like, you know, maybe not right now, but perhaps in a future version.
Okay. So first of all, before selling waifu, I wanted to sell robots.
Okay. Is selling the right word? Maybe we could workshop the terminology a little bit.
Okay. Maybe I just wanted to build a robot and then amaze people with what it can do with the AI technology. I just, like, okay, it doesn't really interest people. So I was like, okay, but then I also did not enjoy building it because it's a bot, and then the image looks like you're an MEB, you're a thief or something. And then, like, and people are getting some cultural resonance on it for in the Asia, especially. Like, yeah.
Let me ask you this. So, like, what do the waifus do?
Oh, so waifu will do some trading automations. And when I mean AI, I'm pretty sure other ML developers will be saying that, oh, okay, yeah, you're building an AI, but then, like, what can you do or something? Like, they're going to be like that. I agree with them, you know. AI has a far more way to go, but I think AI can actually innovate on the user experience where it has to explain some, like, hard concepts in a plain word. So, you know, I'm also kind of inspired from the other Asian project called Magic Newton. But then imagine the difference between Magic Newton saying that word as, like, some complex AI agent from magical word to just a friendly waifu where you always have to listen to her advice when you get married. It's different, you know? So we want to make something user experience that could actually one can relate to using AI. And I'm pretty sure I can get the data from the idea we just talked about, like, navigating those hops and all that. And it could simply include, like, a stop order. It could also include, like, trading a best route on our clock, and then aggregate all these informations that I have on the current backend and then send it to the waifu to learn. I think it's a huge advancement for just using the DeFi technology out there, because when I met the friend from who claims himself is a shitcoin trader, he needs to have, like, a 3 monitor. One is a deck screener. One is the project page to swap. And the other page is to look into the Discord to check the vibes. And if my waifu can do all these things by just prompting a chat and then getting all these datas, I think my shitcoin trader friend would like it. Yeah.
That's very interesting. So, like, this might be a little bit of a tangent, but one of the things I've always found fascinating about the differences between Eastern and Western culture is that, like, Before I got into DeFi, I worked in TradFi, and I was predominantly just like managing pensions for small and medium sized companies, just a lot of bond stuff. It wasn't super glamorous, which is one of the reasons why I was so drawn to DeFi and the modernness of it. But one of the things I distinctly remember having to learn, because I had a lot of clients that were also in Asia, had a lot of firms where I would manage the US division's pension pursuant to US regulations. And like one of the things I always found really interesting is that like in the US in particular, managing the finances of a family is typically seen as a masculine role. Whereas in Asia, Japan, China, Korea, et cetera, it's typically considered a feminine role. And so I always found this really interesting because I would show up at these, I worked at Merrill and then Citi and then Merrill again for a little over a decade. But like, regardless of where I was at the time, I would show up at these high performer, award show things or just like things where they took all of the highest revenue generating people. And it would just be nothing but like, this is, pretty common trope in crypto, but it'd be like a lot of white dudes and a lot of Asian girls. And it's not necessarily for like any particular reason about white dudes, Asian girls, but it was because in the US, managing finances in a family or for a company even is considered very masculine. Whereas in Asia, it's like a very feminine role. That's something I've learned. I didn't really know that going into it, but it's a very different thing. And so the reason why I bring this up is because like you had mentioned the concept of your waifu managing your finances for you. And I think that a lot of American people might hear that and think that might be a relatively foreign concept for Americans. Whereas I think that's pretty much the norm in Asia. Is that correct?
In Asia, we just give money to those waifus. And yeah, it's correct. But like, we've already seen these proven cases with the couple between white men in America and then the Asian woman in America, I guess, to be honest. Let's just think about it. Let's go with the personal story instead. I was like, okay, I've been in this like crypto parties and then went to nightclubs or something like that. Then they, Rabe or some whatever. And then you go there and then the first thing you find out that they're just only men. Okay, I thought that regardless of kind of like a finance, I mean, we're all kind of like degens in the crypto. And then we found out that in trenches, like we don't really have women. So it was like, okay. And I realized, as a man, maybe we need some companion to just navigate our WAGMI success, like crypto life, I guess. I mean, we are going to try to have the touch of grass and then have a real life. But then just having a virtual companion before doing that is pretty much okay before, doing it, right? So that's why I just figured out that maybe it's better to have waifu when most of the users are now just coming in from the Asia right now. So yeah, just check the data of my app using Clops and then just realize that most of the people are coming from Indonesia, Southeast Asia, and I'm pretty sure we can get the cultural resonance of it. And yeah,
that makes sense to me. I think it's a very potentially spicy subject, but it resonates with me, and this is something that I've been thinking about for honestly from long before I even got into crypto, just like the cultural differences around gender roles and managing finances for a company or even a family. And I think these like cultural differences manifest in a lot of ways too. It's a very fascinating subject. What I would be curious about, because Monad has a lot of people, not just in the US and Asia, but also Monad has a massive Nigerian community. And I actually don't know in Africa if managing finances is considered a masculine or like feminine, gender association.
Yeah, Nigerian is like the top first user base that we have right now. And yeah, I'd like to know more about their culture to see if they accept waifus and then, they make waifus manage money. Yeah.
That's awesome. Let's talk about anime. So these are not three-dimensional waifus. These are two-dimensional waifus. I'm assuming that you are a big fan of anime. I think that's a reasonably safe assumption on my part. What would you say are some of your favorite shows?
Oh, my favorite show was Cowboy Bebop. I like the Spike Spiegel and the last scene where he goes to like bang and that kind of stuff. It just really kind of inspired me. Like, okay, I gotta do something that does something cool like this guy or whatever. And then also, I've been watching Jujutsu Kaisen a lot. Also, what? Recently, I'm trying to find some good anime to watch right now. What else? Yeah, I'm just in search of it. Just Jujutsu Kaisen was my last anime to track. And then I'm just recently watching One Piece.
So you're casual. You're casual.
Kind of cap. So like, if you start to go deeper and deeper, the anime title gets so long. So the longest title that I tried was Konosuba. But if you just kind of, it's like God's blessing on this wonderful world.
Or I've been reincarnated as another world as a hero, but my power level is actually one. You wouldn't believe it. My friends are here too. Wow, what a surprise. Season two.
You can't figure out who's the most anime guy looking into the title of it.
Yeah. It's a very poignant observation that resonates with me. If you're looking for something, I would strongly recommend Frieren. It is so good.
Oh, Frieren. Yeah, I watched that. It's legendary. Yeah. It just feels like you finish the main quest that then like you just kind of do side quests in a Zelda or something. And it just feels so calm and just really good. But yeah, I mean, I'm just so worried if the Zarya would die in the recent comics right now. I'm just kind of worried about that. Yeah, I would be so sad if she dies.
So you have read the manga?
Yeah, I'm watching it.
Okay, so you're not a casual. Come on to you, Yingsik.
Yeah, like, it's just that I can't remember the translation of what I'm reading. So I'm reading in Korean.
With Frieren, all of the characters' names are German, I believe. And they're all like very on the nose German translations too. Like I think like the warrior's name is like tough guy or something. I'm probably butchering it. Yeah. Like what are some of the more like for your waifus? Like are there any particular animes that you're drawing inspiration from in the creation of your like waifus?
Oh yeah. So I wanted to go something with like a Frieren or something, but then just realized that maybe would look kind of not attractive as seen in anime. So I think I'm just gonna follow on Haruhi Suzumiya. Yeah, I think it kind of fits well. I mean, it's like she's like God trying to do new things, and then her friend is like alien, like I don't know, like a person from future or something. So I try to get inspired from that. The other part would be I look into B-Shoujo. B-Shoujo is like a biggest American virtual YouTuber platform. So that's where I look into the... And then I want to make something like a virtual idol for crypto. Mm-hmm. And then try to like, you know, use it as like a, you know, going through some advertising like crypto projects or something. And I'm recently recruiting the Korean woman or something, like women to go with that. I guess I'm not sure if it's gonna work, but I want to make a crypto entertainment virtual YouTuber company release something cool with the waifus and stuff. Yeah,
bullish. So like if I sign up for your service and then like let's say you're also on your service, is my waifu gonna look the same as your waifu? Are we gonna be like sharing a waifu? Is this gonna be like a polygamy type situation where one waifu has many husbandos?
I think so. I think we're just gonna have one waifu with the fans. I kind of see it as like a fan and idol situation. We want to make personal waifus as they can, but then this AI starts to like deteriorate and then starts drawing wrong things, and then just decided that okay, maybe we just do it one by one and then just pray for AI to improve, and then maybe we'll have some personal AI. But yeah, right now we're just working on the VTuber idols and kind of stuff. Yeah.
That's awesome. And so like for these AIs, they're going to be interacting with the Central Limit Order Book on behalf of the users. Is that correct?
Yes. So I think there are just like many ways to do it right now. So it could be, I think the first stage would be just to show the VTuber so that people can get excited. And after that, we're going to, when the first VTuber is on pretty much TikTok or Instagram trying to build some fandom, I'm going to work on some backend to provide data to LMM using Eliza, or Also, I could also set some backend so that it can automate a certain kind of actions where it manages the filling up the volumes for the listing projects, or it could be atomically hedging, getting the price from the CoinGecko and then compare with the price on our club and then just buy more certain assets based on the price difference. And then we connect the AI interface and then ask people to do it.
So like, what would that look like from the user's perspective?
So when users try to interact, I think first 2 months, I think we'll just have to go with my Klopp Haifu terminal. So basically users just going to watch tokenized agents popping like 10x or 5x because of like these x's are up the prices, like the marketing tool. I want to see that happen. It's going to be the first experience of that token just pumping up. And then a later stage, we're going to have a product called Haifu Chat, where users will go to the chat room and then users pay these tokenized agent. And then with the payment of the, like, let's just say that there's this waifu token called FreeRen, and FreeRen does a certain job where we set up. It could be just atomically hedging. And then you go into that and then you pay like 5 FreeRen token, and then FreeRen just open up a chat for you. And then I'm going to input some certain actions in Eliza. So there's like an example where you put the prompt, hey, place my USDC and then expose it to atomic hedging to the trading, or it could be like FreeRen, show me money making magic. And then FreeRen will just answer this, here, just sign this and I'm going to make your money to do this, blah, 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 with some long text. If you agree by signing, it would deposit the asset to the certain contracts or certain agents built on the agent wallet or something, and then use that funds to operate the fund. And then you can always check the balances because we're going to connect the API of each agent to look into with the prompt. And I expect that this is not going to be like a easily doable. First, we're just going to do one by one. And then once this model is ready to be deployed, we're going to go like trench mode where people can just modify it and then just, you know, go with that. But then it seems like the problem about this current AI Memecoin launchpad is that I don't think it's not about quantity, you know, AI agents. I think it's all about now quality. So instead of just making so many AI agents that could confuse as like a meme coin, I try to focus on one agent that does well, and then it actually acts like a waifu. So we try to focus on the quality and then use our own decks to improve on the market performance, and then also use some measures to protect its price. Yeah.
How are you guys looking at handling scenarios where maybe the AI makes a mistake or like misinterprets something?
We try to provide the option where people can just easily withdraw, which is why we just try to set the AI for just an interface as like an LLM, so that if the thing happens, we can actually expect that that could happen in the automated client. So in the trading perspective, atomically hedging with the CoinGecko price shouldn't pretty much actually create a problem, unless CoinGecko price goes like nuts or something.
Like what if it like misses a decimal? Like what if it thinks it's 18 decimals and it's actually 6 decimals? Because I know we were talking about decimals earlier. It's like, maybe the AI hedges the wrong number of like decimals or something like that.
That's very scary, but that's like dev skill issue. So like, I think I have to reimburse that in that case. But like, I think the decimal mistake should be very low because we try to get the number from the contract itself. So unless the contract modifies the decimals, then shouldn't be a problem because we always get the decimals from the contract event after adding the pair, and then the contract will get the decimals from the contract itself. And some trolls might actually change the decimal, but then there's no project like that. Like it's changing decimals. It's like, I don't know. I haven't seen any project or token contract that actually does that to seriously getting listed though.
Yeah. Got it. So it's less about like the AI doing the right thing and more about removing the number of things that the AI touches. And like, you know, like the AI couldn't misinterpret the decimals because it's not interpreting the decimals. It's like, you know, your backend or something like that is interpreting the decimals and the AI just sends information to the backend. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah, so AI would just take over the interface. I think there's like a different kinds of AI. So there's definitely like a there's an AI that does reinforcement learning that uses a strategy like, you know, what I call it, some Medallion fund was trying to do. But that's just another client that would do. So we don't really let AIs to LLM to calculate the numbers and then submit the number itself. Rather, it would just be like a support agent where it is not like Coinbase, it gives out personal information or something, but it just does the thing what is already out there and then just submit that. And I think in this case, it's actually fine. It's not like these agents will actually store like sensitive information or something. It's just only getting the information from the APIs. And we're going to definitely like open source these, how these codes are going to work so that some other developers can come in that, oh, maybe this is wrong or that, and then we can fix it with the issues and all that. So in our GitHub repo of Haifu, we're actually kind of planning on this new waifu call, like a Sayuri or some other for the atomically hatching the asset prices with the arbitrage difference between the central exchange and the DEX. So I'm going to show the code and then people will look into it. Yeah.
Interesting choice for a waifu. Yeah. Anyway, moving on. The waifus are really more just kind of like traffic directors then. So like they're interpreting what the user wants and then they're connecting the user to the correct part of like the backend function. So the waifus aren't really like holding data. They're not really like executing with like full agentic permissions originally. They're more like, you know, the quarterback, and they're, you know, throwing the user to the correct process. Is that maybe one way to look at it?
Yeah, I don't believe that AI agents can actually do that. I think it's all kind of buzzword. So, but even though if you want to set up like an agentic experience, you have to start it from there. Otherwise, where are you going to start? You know, at least, you know, everyone is like saying that, okay, we're going to deliver this agentic experience or whatever. But then like, let's be honest, like, you know, you have to do that first to get there. You know, it's like, you know, it's, I know it's ideal and then you want to make a better world, but then like, what can you do if you can't even make a support agent that actually looks into the service that you're actually running, you know? So that's my first step. But then we have a culture, we have a waifu trying to support traders right now. So I guess if we build a culture, so I think the importance of culture is this, you know, if we build a culture, people can dream about the next steps. But if we just say that we're going to deliver the technology and then our technology is so great that it's going to change the world, people will just disappoint. And then, you know, like, okay, where's the real tech? You know, I just get inspired from the Amazon that Amazon was not even trying to make AWS at all. Like they did not try to build AWS. They just wanted to build a bookstore that could actually just have a faster or just marketplace that actually goes with the best infrastructure out there. But then they just realized that they have a leftover resources and then they turned it into AWS. So like people would focus on, okay, we're getting waifus, but then we just realized that we have a leftover resources to use our AI to make them learn and then do something while we already have a proven model that is done by a proper quant trading strategy or something. And we can use that data. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense to me. So I think we're coming up on the end of the podcast. Before we close it out, is there anything that your community or that people looking to join your community, in any alpha that you'd like to leak to them or anything that is coming down the pipeline for people to get excited about? Any new functionality, any products, any points programs, anything like that?
Oh, I think Haifu is just going to launch its product on June. I think it's going to be very small, but we just want to test on the terminal to be done on the Monad testnet so that if there's any like anything wrong. So we're going to go with the testnet agents on starting with the market making, because if you make a DEX, you need a three actors, one trader, three from the team, and then two is the market maker. I had that with the algorithm, and then these LPs. We're going to replace LPs with our waifus, so that if you deposit money on waifus, we give out the share of our trading fees to waifus so that you can actually profit just putting the money in. So I think, but yeah, LPs is going to be waifus. Maybe it will be called standard vault, but then I'm just going to go like powered by waifus or haifus or something. And then I think people will love it. Yeah, like it's better than just holding like ETH USDC LP token with the long ticker, but then you just see this LP token with the waifu logo in it, and then Roxy or like, you know, FreeRAN or something. And then people would ask, oh, okay, what is this? And then like, oh, this is LP token. And then you can look much more cooler than those holding these like LPs with the L sign. So that's the plan. Yeah.
That's awesome.
People are going to be so happy when they open up a wallet.
I think like a lot of people will. Maybe not every person is going to be a big fan of the waifu approach. Like for instance, my wife would probably not like it. But in general, I really like the concept of like, you don't have to make everyone kind of happy. You want to have some people like dedicated, you know, users who are just like your champions. And if you have some people that hate it, you know, they can hate it. That's fine. You don't need to onboard every person in the world, right? Just a few billion. And I really like that your approach is like very laser focused on a very specific market, which is probably a little bit overrepresented in crypto, if we're being honest. Yeah, I think it's like direct, it's on the nose, but I don't think that's a bad thing. I think there's something very honest about this degenerate friendly approach. And I'm a big fan of what you do and your experience, both as a mechanism designer and as an engineer. For people that are listening or watching, what is the best way for them to interact with your community or join your community?
I would love to see suggestions of the new waifu names. This is a project built by a community and I enjoy building it. I've been in this like 5 years in crypto, and then I just don't want to go to this crypto approach, showing new technology. Any publicity is good publicity. And this is the projects that I just enjoy and want to have fun. So about the newcomers, oh yeah, I'm pretty sure they'll ask about the token utilities and all that. So HiFu is basically like a virtuals. So if you want to buy these kind of agent tokens, agents, or just co-own it, you have to use HiFu to buy it. And it's like a same as virtuals. We're going to launch it on the HiFu terminal. And then, yeah, try to have fun, try to engage with the chats, and then you can also deposit liquidity in there. So that's pretty much how to use HiFu. Yeah. And
that's awesome.
Just be expect. Yeah. We're going to do membership so that Anons can become a husband member. We call the members like husbands. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
So basically, we really don't have a product yet, but we expect to have like next month if things go well. I'm reaching out to these kind of like two capitals right now. And I hope we get some investment.
For people looking to join your community, is there a like Discord or Telegram or website that they can go to?
Oh, sure. We have a Telegram, Discord, and a website. Try to go to our Twitter account, Twitter at haifu.fun. So if you go into that, there will be a link tree, haifu, and then you can find Twitter, Discord, or a Telegram link over there, and then try to engage in communications. Yeah.
Awesome. Cool. Well, I really appreciate you coming onto the show. This was like, I had a lot of fun recording this episode. We went really deep into the stablecoin piece, which I didn't know that going into this. I had a lot of fun talking about it. And then we learned a lot about the central limit order book. And then we learned a lot about anime and waifus and explored some very interesting subjects. I had a blast recording. This is like a lot of fun. So dude, thank you so much for coming on board and for talking with me today. It means a lot. Would love to have you back on to dive more into how this product is, how it's shaping out, how it's changing, how it's evolving as you continue to iterate and continue to ship. So yeah, dude. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I can't wait for you guys to launch in June.
Thank you for having me. For me, I just wanted to start a genuine project so that I could enjoy in crypto. I hope it goes well. And yeah, I've been building this in crypto projects more than 5 years. And then I just started to figure out that I just want to enjoy building it, you know? So I'm more than welcome to show any progress that I have, or if you guys have any questions, I'm willing to go over it, but it's not for everyone. Like, I agree, but we just want to have fun. Yeah. And
hell make yeah.
a real product. Yeah.
Hell yeah, dude. That's awesome. Well, dude, thanks again. And for everyone listening, thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time. Bye.